Thanks for joining us on the Port City Church podcast. More information about Port City Church is available at portcitychurch.org.
Good morning. It's great to welcome all of you guys here, welcome all of our campuses together. And as we begin, we're talking about this idea of what would it look like if God's work in your life, like what he was doing in you, actually made its way out of you just in the normal course of your day in the most normal way possible. What if it became sort of the default way in which you live? In fact, the definition of normal is a usual state or condition. What if that were the normal case, condition of your life, that sort of God's work was central and evident in every moment, every interaction? That's what we're trying to figure out and address. It's interesting, there's the Bible's divided into two parts. You have the old part and the new part. The old covenant, the new covenant, the Old Testament, the New Testament. And there's a command in the Old Testament that says something like this. It says, if you obey everything that God has asked you to do, you'll be blessed. And most of us like that. And I'll tell you why, because it puts us in charge. We like it. Tell me what to do, and I'll do it. I'm good at executing stuff, and surely there'll be some grace in there when I don't execute perfectly, but doggone it, I like that a lot. Because the other side says, basically, you're hopeless, it ain't going to work, and you're going to have to trust someone else to do it. And you're like, man, if I can, I'll do it myself because it's a lot easier and less hassle than anything else, and trusting someone else. And that's how we kind of operate. In fact, this time of year always reminds me, because a couple of years ago, I love the bracket challenge. I love filling out brackets. My bracket's not doing great. Like most other people, it's probably not. But a few years ago, Warren Buffett put out a challenge. If you could have a perfect bracket, he would give you $1 billion. I don't know if you remember this or not. It actually became my job. I was like, okay, man, I can make a lot of money in a few weeks if I can just get on. So me and a buddy sat down. We worked on this like it was our job. And we're going through. And you know what's funny is the more like you listen to people and the more you made picks, the more convinced I was that we had a perfect bracket. And I was just, the more engrossed, it was like, okay, man, and looking at this and how hard can this be? There's only 64 teams and you just have to pick a few games and it's really not that complicated. And then you realize it's like impossible. And it took all the way out until the second game of the tournament for me to realize it was impossible. And then as soon as it started, I was like, oh, I knew we should have. And we started all the excuses and all the reasons why it's rigged and all the other stuff and basically gave up because it's impossible. It is impossible. I think a lot of us approach God the same way. We hear this idea that he said, hey, man, if you just do good, you'll be fine. We're like, oh, I think I can do this. And the more you feel, so like, oh, you come into a worship service and you sing a great song, you're like, I think I can do this. I think I can do this. And we can't. And we can't. And this is where the gospel comes to bear on our lives, the central reality that God did for us what we could never do for ourselves. That's sort of the central idea. And so I want us to look at this a little different. We have to do some work today in this. But as I mentioned last week, just like the idea that God has asked us basically to do some things and then he'll bless us or we'll reflect his image. And namely, he said he wants us to love him, to love God, love him, respond to him in love perfectly, and to love everybody else perfectly. He wants a pure affection, this is from last week, a pure affection for him and a pure reflection of him in the world around us. Pure affection, pure reflection. Anything less than that breaks the demands of this relationship. That's what we talked about. And a lot of us grew up thinking that there's something wrong with God. That's when someone asks you, hey, do you think God's going to let you into heaven? You're like, well, I've been pretty good. Or whatever your answer might be, because we have this system, this way of thinking about the fact that something isn't quite right with God. And a lot of us, maybe you grew up in a tradition in a church that was hellfire and brimstone, right? It was like just, turn or burn, get right or get left, whatever cliche you had, you grew up with that. And your response to Jesus was basically, I'm just scared to death of hell. And that's an okay thing, right? That gets a lot of people sort of, yep, check that box. But I don't think that's the whole story. Because the other side is we kind of wrestle with hell and the how that seems. We sort of go, well, maybe it's not that big of a deal. And we sort of lessen God's glory or his image or the seriousness with which he made us. And we live in this sort of tension. And we think about separation as being, well, separation isn't that big of a deal. Or we think about separation as being, hellfire and brimstone. And last week, what I tried to get you to understand is I want you to think of separation much differently. Separation isn't the fact that you can articulate what is wrong. Separation is the fact that you know something ain't quite right. And this is the picture we used from last week. If you were here, you'll remember this. If you weren't, this is new to you, and you'll go, oh, that's my daughter. She's now 21. She was about 18 months at the time. Now, in case you can't see this really well, there's a 5-pound bag of flour on the floor in front of her, that little red is. And you notice the Lazy Susan sort of cracked open in the back. There was a command given that thou shalt not enter into the Lazy Susan, for in the moment you do, there shall be death, right? She knew that. So she opens it, and you see the rest. And then when I walk in, she looks at us like, what's up? Right? See, separation isn't like cowering in fear. Separation is like, I don't know what you're talking about. What's the problem? I'm like, this is the flower in my hair was like, well, the look I was going for. But the reason that you know she knows something ain't quite right is because of that little yellow object sitting in front of her, which is the dustpan. She knew something ain't right, and she was doing everything she could to clean the mess up. All right, this is us. This is us. Every time you say, I'll promise I'll do this, every time you say, I'll just go to church, every time you say, I'll just be nice, you're picking up the dustpan and you're trying to clean the mess of yourself because you know something ain't quite right and something has gone wrong. You're just not sure what it is. If you're, you know, what I would suggest, and you know, the devotions that we post are all along these lines this week, but Romans chapter 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8 are just chock full of this kind of language. And I want to try to unpack some of that in our time together. The assumption that we're making is that you were made by God and for God. Every human being has been stamped with the image of God, and his purpose is for you to bear his image completely and fully and respond to him freely in the same way. And what we've been saying, and we've put these two things that will be on their screen, is that everything finds its meaning and its purpose within the context of its relationship to God. Everything does. That's not an overstatement. If you weren't here, I explained that last week. Every system on the planet has some version of this. It tries to define itself within its context of its relationship to God, and every human being does as well. And the second thing we just said is that we may not know what's wrong, but we know something's not right. And if that's where you are, then I want you to pay particular attention to what we're going to talk about today. Because you're going to spend your whole life trying to figure out, what's wrong with what I'm doing? What's wrong with the way I'm living? What's wrong with what I'm saying? And if you're asking that question, it's because you know something ain't right. And until you deal with that, you're always going to sort of be trapped. And so what I want to do is we're going to talk about these two words. I want to talk about the idea of what we do and the idea of what has been done. And the way we think of this sort of culturally is we start off over here on the right-hand side and we say, what needs to be done? And then we begin to ask ourselves, what should we do in order to make sure that this gets done? Everybody's to-do list that you make is fundamentally about getting stuff done, right? That's how we think. That's how we fundamentally operate in the world around us. What needs to get done, and then what can we do to make that happen? So when it comes to a relationship that's broken, we say, what needs to be done and what can I do to fix it, to make it right? And when the answer is nothing, that's when we have a problem. My goal is to take and reverse this today. I want to reverse this. And I'll leave that right there. So I want you to imagine for just a moment, you're at a restaurant. And you go to this restaurant and you're all by yourself because you just wanted to have lunch by yourself. I don't know if any of you have that before, right? Sometimes you just go, I'm going to lunch and nobody's with me. It feels so good. And you order and you eat and you're enjoying it and you're looking out and you're going, this is the best meal with the best company. I'm just kidding. Y'all have done that, right? Where you're like, your schedule's so enough. You get that window for lunch, you're like, oh my gosh, I can like stop and just eat a meal without. And someone walks up to your table, the waiter or the waitress walks up to your table and says, sir or ma'am, hope you enjoyed your meal, just want to know it's been taken care of. Now, you're usually startled just a little bit, and then you start looking around, trying to figure out who did this, right? Who did this? What do they think's wrong with me? They can't afford my meal, right? We all start this kind of idea, like, who did this to me? Gratitude is usually not the first thing that pops up. It's usually like, who was it and what do they want or why are they doing this? And then there's a second thought is like, well, what if they left a tip? Because I don't want, if they're a chump, I don't want to like a chump. So then you start all these games in your head about what you're going to do about this. And you might sit and you might tinker with this for about 4 or 5 minutes trying to figure it out. You realize there's no one in the restaurant that you know. And now you're sitting there and you're left with sort of this dilemma. You're sitting there trying to decide, what are you going to do? Are you going to leave your bigger tip? Are you going to demand that the waitress cancel the thing? What are you going to do? Because there's another thought in your head. What if you walk out and it's just a joke and you get arrested when you walk? That's my fear. Local pastor arrested for stealing a meal, you know. Don't these things go through your head? Or I'm the only one? So you're sitting there and this is what you have to say. You have to say, what has been done? What has been done? And what has been done is that someone has paid for your bill, paid your bill, paid what you owed. And so the second thing you've got to do is decide what you're going to do about what has been done. And what you do is at some point you have to stand up and you have to walk as though what has been done has actually been done. And you walk in, you get to the door and you're kind of looking over your shoulder, making sure nobody's about to jump on you and tackle you or whatever you think. Now imagine if you're sitting there and you're going through all in your head all those, I can't believe someone would pay for me, blah, blah, blah. I can't do, who do they think they are? And they reach in, you don't have your wallet. Now your first question is, oh my God, thank you so much. Somebody did something for me that I could not do for myself. And you still sit there and you wonder, and this principle is still the same. What are you going to do about what's been done? Now, this is the best way that I can think about what God has done for us. When we think about the gospel, we're going to sit on two questions. What has been done? And then what will you do about what's been done? And start to reverse this process. Instead of saying, what needs to be done? What can I do about it? Say, what's been done? And what will I do in response to it? It's a fundamentally different way of thinking about what God, who he is, and the system. Every human being, every system has some component of this, and this is the only one that reverses the order. It's the only one on the planet that reverses the order. Remember, we talked about this. Please don't say, oh, Jesus isn't the only way, that's so exclusive. This is the only system by which every human being gets in the same way. It's the only one. And I want you to think about this. What are the implications of that on you? One of the things we talk about around Port City is we want to create places. We want to create environments where you can experience the gospel and process its implications. Where you can experience the gospel. And we want you to hear the gospel, right? We want you to experience it. When you walk in, people say this all the time, Mike, if I came to your church, the walls would fall down. And they walk in the church and the walls don't fall down. They realize, oh, wow. Maybe I can come just like I am. Maybe you will accept me just like I am. Maybe you will welcome me the way that I am with what I think and what I've done. And that's an experience. You experience that first time when you show up and you realize someone kicked you out or said you don't look right or sound right or think right or whatever, and you're out of here. You actually experience someone reaching out and extending a hand to you. And so we would love to help you. That's experiencing the gospel. And two is to process its implications. What are the implications of the gospel? The reason this is so important, because when you identify what the gospel has done in your life, you will actually begin to see yourself in God's story. But I think a lot of us don't get this because of the way either the gospel is presented or we think about it or the fact that maybe we don't think about it. And I told you last week, I was challenged years ago to preach the gospel to yourself every day. And I was like, okay, Jesus came, he died, he rose. Jesus came, he died, he rose. And I began to think about this. What are the implications on me? And looking back over my life for a really long period of time, I began to notice a couple of things that the gospel has implications on my life that might be different from yours. Now, please hear me say, this is not some, everybody's going the same way. This is to say that the gospel, Jesus meets you right where you are to do what needs to be done in your life. And even though there might be 15 things that are true, one of these things might be the most true about you where you are. And I want to give you permission to think about what are the implications of the gospel, of Jesus' death and resurrection, his life extended for you on your life right where you are. Let me tell you what I mean by that. All right, so when I was growing up, I grew up in the church world, right? And so that meant lots of camps, lots of youth speakers, and all the youth speakers that came to our church were all former football players. They're always big and muscular, and they came and said, before I found Christ, I partied a lot, had a lot of women, and then I found Christ, and now my life is all perfect. And as like a 13-year-old kid, I'm going, that's exactly what I want. have your cake and eat it too, right? So I wrestle with this, and I'm not trying to disparage, because that's somebody people's story, and I think that's a great thing. But I was 13. I was a pretty good kid. I didn't drink, I didn't cuss, I didn't have girls. It wasn't because of choice, it was just opportunity. There were no opportunities for me, so it was kind of... And so that's how I lived. And so I would hear these things. And what I heard about is all these sins these people had racked up, and that God had forgiven them for their sins, and therefore they became different people and their lives went well. I remember looking at mine going, what sins? I'm 13, I've not really done, let's see, I think I told a lie when I was 9. It was the right thing. Then I heard this. In Luke chapter 7, there's a story that happens to Jesus. A woman comes up to Jesus and she washes his feet, right? And there, Jesus is in a room with a bunch of religious leaders, and this lady happens to be a prostitute. And one of the religious leaders says, if you knew what kind of woman that was in front of you, you would never let her touch you. And so Jesus tells him a story like he always does. He didn't say, oh, you're a knucklehead. He just tells him a story. He said, suppose there was a guy and he had two debtors. He had loaned some money out. These two guys owed him money, and one guy owed him $5,000 and the other guy owed him $50. And the master calls them both in and says, you guys, you both don't owe me anything. Your debts are forgiven. You're totally good to go. Which one do you think would love more? And the guy said, well, I suppose the guy who was owed $5,000. He said, right. The person who's forgiven much loves much, and the person who's forgiven little loves little. Now, at 13 years old, I'm thinking, oh boy, whatever shall I do? I know I'll go rack up a whole bunch of sins so I can love much. That's what I'll do. Because right, I'm sitting here thinking, I've just got little sins. Little sins is little grace. Big sins is big grace. I thought, what am I missing? What are the implications on the gospel for my life? At 13, 14, right? Somewhere along there, 15, 16 years old, I began to pursue a relationship with Christ. Like to really go, God, if you're real, if you're true, I'm going to try to understand who you are and how you are and what you want from me. And what over the course of that time, and even looking back, and I wish someone had taught me this earlier, but looking back, I had to wrestle because, well, yes, I knew forgiveness. I had wonky stuff in my head that I needed to be forgiven for. I had all kinds of things. I got that, but it wasn't the driver. What I realized, what I was afraid of, is that somehow God's purposes for my life wouldn't be as good as my own. I had good purposes for my life. My life was well planned, and it was really good. And to give that over to God was a significant thing for me. And what it became about was reading things like 1 John, where it says, God demonstrated his love for us, that while he would send his son to you, it became all of a sudden that God demonstrated his love for me. Then what began to motivate me wasn't so much that I was forgiven, although that was true. What began was that God could be trusted because he loved me. That when I was trying to decide, do I want to, you know, leave the career in architecture and go do something over here in the church world, or I want to do this, I began to realize that God can be trusted. His plans are better than mine. His ways are higher than mine. Verses like 1 Peter 5, when it's a translation, it says that to cast your worries upon Christ, for he is most careful with you. Those began to resonate with me. So as I look back over my life, there was a lot of different things that I believe about what the gospel does, but that was the thing that resonated. What happens is I began to understand my sort of pursuit of God's, of trusting him with his goodness. I realized that that's how my story intersected with him. It was about trust. It wasn't about this crazy redeemed past, although all of us, and I'll talk about that in just a minute, it was about this one step at a time future, just trusting him one step at a time, even when I didn't know, and especially when it wasn't the way I would have planned it. And that was my story. And the reason I tell you this is because every one of you have a story that's just like that. It's just not going to look like mine. And it's not going to look like the football players. And it's not going to look like somebody. It's going to look like yours. And what you've got to do is you've got to do the hard work to understand what are the implications of the gospel on you, right? If someone walks up to you and says, hey, man, I got a solution. Well, you're going, oh, a solution to what? There must be a problem, right? When someone offers a solution, the implications are there is a problem. This is where we're going to look at. Romans chapter 3, verse 21 through 24 says this. We looked at this last week. But now a righteousness from God apart from the law, has been made known, to which the law and the prophets testify, Now, what's interesting about this is he's basically saying, here's a solution to the problem. Here's the solution. You thought that doing good was going to get you there. You thought that doing something was going to get you there, but it ain't going to work. So here's the solution. So we have to go, oh, there must be a problem. And here's what it is. The righteousness of God comes through faith in Jesus to all who believe. It does not come from you keeping the law or doing right things. It comes through Christ from God. And then he says this, there is no difference. Look at this. For all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God, and all are just, this is two components of the same thing. All have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. You do not have pure affection. You do not have pure reflection. Something is broken. Something is not right. And all are justified freely by his grace through the redemption that came through Jesus Christ. All are justified freely. And so this is where, to me, it gets really interesting. Because there's two big words that I want to talk to you about as we think about this. And these are theological words, and they're important theological words. A lot of modern translations don't use these words anymore, and it's one reason I love some of the older translations of the Bible, because they hold on to these words, because they do matter, and they're not like anything else we have. One of these words is what we will call sanctification. Sanctified. See, if you're an old school preacher, you can say, you go sanctified, wide-eyed, justified. That's the second word. We are justified, justification. These two big words. What you do, what has been done. The order matters. This is what the gospel is, right? So if you read and you keep reading through Romans chapter 5, Romans chapter 6, you'll see something like this. It says, to begin with, Romans 4, it actually says that, hey, it was an act of God. Your faith is what brought his righteousness. You believed him, and he said, done, right? It was that was credited to us. Therefore, since we have been justified, here's that word again, through faith, we now have peace with God. We're right with him again. Through which we have obtained access through faith into this grace in which we now stand. You keep reading. And then it starts talking about this idea that sin entered the world through one man and everything got messed up. And then righteousness entered the world through one man and everything got redeemed. That's what Romans 6 is about. One man's sin wrecked the whole thing. One man's righteous act made the whole thing right. Now, then you come to the question, you say, okay, did one man's sin really mess up everything? Are we really sinful human beings? Is that a condition of the human? Because a lot of people think, well, you know, I think human beings are really good. I think human beings are really good. And my response to that, actually, it's not even that difficult. And the reason I know that human beings aren't good is because I have kids. I never had to teach them to hide stuff, to be sassy, to not share, never. It just came out, they're like, this is mine. I'm like, it is not yours. Like, how could you didn't do anything. It is not yours. How do you think you got the truck? You don't even have a job, right? It's like, how do they think this? Because something inside is broken out of the gate. It's broken. He said, all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. We all come out and go, I can do it myself. That's what it is. And so we get this idea, and so this is what he says. If you read, and this is sort of the summary of it. It says, consequently, just as through one trespass resulted in condemnation for all people, so also one righteous act resulted in justification and the life and life for all people. For just as through the disobedience of one man, many were made sinners, so also through the obedience of one man, the many will be made righteous. And here are these two words again. This idea of justice and righteousness, that something has been done to make us right. And this is the way I define it. If you're watching this, I define this right here is to be made right. That's all it means. You owed something and someone paid it. The demands of the relationship have now been fulfilled. That's from last week. Now, the second thing here is in Romans 6:19. If you keep reading, Romans 6 opens up and it says, so what do we just say? If grace is big, we just sin a bunch more. This is a great question. This is my 13-year-old question. If God's given us grace, why don't we sin a whole bunch so we get really big grace? He says, no, that's not the way you think of it. Then he talks about this idea of presenting your bodies to something for a purpose. If you present your body to lawless deeds, you're going to get a mess. If you present your body to God as available to him, you're going to get something different. And that's the way this works. So I sat down and tried to just sketch this out in my own head because it talks about presenting yourself to righteousness. And what all of us think, when we talk about presenting you presenting your life for righteousness, you automatically think about behavior. What will I do? That's not what this is about. The way I think about this is the condition of my body presented is an instrument of a right relationship to God. When I say what I'm doing is I'm availing myself to you, not in order for you to do something, but because you have done something. And I'll try to explain this in just a minute. Because once we've presented our members as slaves of impurity, what you begin to see is all this other stuff piles on. Let's look at this verse real quick. Just as you once presented your members as slaves to impurity and to lawlessness, leading to more lawlessness, so now present your members as slaves to righteousness, leading to, here's that big word, sanctification. Sanctification is the process by which we are set apart solely and specifically for God's purposes only, the process. So I would write it as like this: to be sanctified is to become right. The process of becoming right. We are made right, and now what we do is we become right in response to the way we've always been made. Now you're going, okay, hold on. So there's an idea, and we go like this. I remember when I was in middle school, I was an awkward 7th and 8th grader, very awkward. And when I was in middle school, I loved the 80s. I grew up in the 80s. It's no secret. I love the 80s. It's like nothing else. And it's interesting. This is all coming back to, I don't know if you've seen this. When we were growing up, we had acid wash jeans. And acid, some of you are like, you're like going back. You're like, yes. And they were like acid wash jeans. And we used to wear, they were a little bit longer. And we used to peg roll them, which is where you took them and you folded them over. Do you remember this? And you would peg roll your jeans. And they're doing this. How's people doing this now? Do y'all remember this? Okay, you would peg roll your jeans, and then you had white Reebok high tops that you wore with them, and this long kind of flowy shirt. And I had one pair of acid wash jeans and one kind of really cool shirt. One day a week, I was really, really with it. The other 7 days, I was a complete waste because I had sweatpants the rest of the time, but one day I had a great outfit. And all these years, it was like, Mom would say, Mike, why do you want to buy this? I said, Mom, because everybody else is doing it. This is what's cool. And then it dawned on me that all those years in middle school, I was trying to dress a certain way in order to be cool. And then about 10 years later, it dawned on me that I already was cool. Do you see the idea? You see the difference? Like all these years, I thought that I was trying to get something by doing something that I already had. And there's a huge difference between dressing a particular way in order to be cool and dressing a particular way because you are cool. Got it? Like, what is it for you? Maybe it's success, right? You're like doing all this other stuff because you think, and all of a sudden you realize, what if God, or you're doing stuff to prove your worth, and what if you were already, or you're doing all this stuff to make you, right? What if you already were? Right, see, we start over here and say, what needs to be done? What am I going to do? And we got to reverse this. We say, what has been done? You have already been made cool, Mike. You are free to peg roll your jeans because it's cool, but not to be cool because you already are cool. You represent cool when you do that. When he says, I gotta undo this. This is really awkward. And so, but think about it. When he asks you to obey him and you go, I'm gonna do really good things for God so that I'll be made right. He's like, no. Don't do good things for me so that you'll be made right. You're already made right. You do good things for me because when you live like that, you're actually reflecting and revealing me. It's a fundamentally different way of thinking about this. Fundamentally different. To present your bodies as a slave to righteousness isn't about behavior, but rather it is about serving or devoting yourself to a relationship in which the demands of that relationship are already made right, and this sets you up on a course by which you become more and more available solely and specifically for His purpose. And all of a sudden, when you're at work, you're available to whatever it is that God might be wanting you to do in that moment, what He might be doing in that moment, right? This is the picture that I'm talking about. And this is what I think it means. The big thing is, if you think about this, so when you start to process yourself, there are two real key components that go along with this. What has been done? We have been justified. We've been made right. And what that means is basically two big components. Number one is forgiveness. Forgiveness simply means you don't owe anybody anything. When God said, "I have forgiven you for your sins," and you say, "Okay, I'll do better next time," He's like, that's like looking around trying to see if they left a tip or not. It's all been taken care of. You don't owe anything. It's already, you have been justified by faith in Christ. There is no law, there is no evidence. You have been justified by what He has already done. Forgiveness. The second is redemption. Redemption is the fact that He uses everything. He uses everything. Redemption is the promise that those of us, we are freely justified, and that we have all fallen short, and we are freely justified through the redemption, through faith in Jesus, through whom redemption comes. He uses everything. Let me tell you how this plays itself out. Some of you are here, and this is just a real cursory view. We'll give you a bigger list in just a moment. Some of you are here, and your past, you've got like a truck behind you of all the stuff that you've done to other people to cause harm. You've got just a wake of relational damage. And sometimes you think, I won't live long enough to make it up. And you're right. And the good news of the gospel is you don't have to. Right? I'm not saying this to let you off the hook. What I'm saying is, I'm saying this for you to trust in what Christ has done. Killing your son on a cross isn't letting you off the hook. It's taking it about as seriously as you can. When you kill God over my sin, it ain't lessening its importance. It raises its importance. This is significant. And so what He says is you are forgiven. And so what happens when you embrace the gospel, you say, God, thank you that all of my past is forgiven and I don't have to work. I may have some relational work to do, but I don't have to work to earn your forgiveness. It is finished. It is done. And you go, thank you. I love that part of the gospel. That's my story. Others of you, you didn't do a lot of stuff wrong. You were actually wronged. Maybe it was abuse, maybe it was something else, and your whole past is just filled with this. When someone says, you need to be forgiven, you're like, forgiven? What did I do? How does the gospel come to bear on you? Do you need forgiveness? Yes, 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 we all got that original Adam thing, and we need grace, but just hear me out. When you hear the fact that God promises to redeem all those things, and that's where healing comes, you go, oh my gosh, that's where the gospel resonates with me, that God actually takes that and He uses it in some crazy, miraculous way for His purposes and for His good. And the past that I've gone through doesn't mean that I will never have life, because it wasn't found in my circumstances then and it ain't found in my circumstances now. It's found in Him, and my relationship defines it. And all of a sudden that becomes your story. Your story intersects with God's. Every single person has this. Something, maybe it's one of those, maybe it's forgiveness. And listen, for me, over the years, it's become, all these things have kind of raised the bar as I walk with them, going, yep, 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 yep. But when I was first trying to understand this, it didn't. I had to pick one, kind of go, what's the one thing that sort of resonates that allows me to see where my story intersects God's? For some of you, it's freedom, because your whole life you felt like you're obligated to everybody. You finally realize that if you can just see Him, if you can just walk with Him, you trust Him, you're free. Maybe it's an addiction thing and freedom is your thing. Maybe that's your story. Maybe it's acceptance. Maybe your whole life you've never felt like anybody cared about you. And you realize that God loves you and He accepts you just like you are. And you're like, that's my story. That's my gospel story. What about strength? What about strength? Some of you, I've seen it. You've been through stuff. And it ain't because anything anybody's done. It's just stuff that's happened. Circumstances you found yourself in. I ask you this all the time. How many of you have something in your life that you wish God would take away? And the hands go up all the time. Some struggle that you wish wasn't a struggle anymore. Paul had the same thing, and Paul said, God, I've prayed and asked that you take this thorn in my flesh away from me. I've asked you, I've entreated, I've begged you to just take it away. And what I heard you say is, I'm not going to take it away. I'm going to allow this to continue to be a struggle because I want you to understand that it is in your weakness that my strength is made perfect. It is in your weakness that you understand that my grace is sufficient for you, and that becomes your gospel story. What are the implications of his resurrection, his life, his invitation on you? What about his goodness? Some of you, your whole life, you just, everything good, something good happens, you're just waiting for the other shoe to fall. You're like, okay, it's been good for a long time. When's it going to be bad? And your whole life is this just hesitant. And then you feel like, I got to do even better. I got to do even better because if I've been good for so long and it's just pressure, maybe just to trust that he is really careful with you and he's really good. And that becomes your story. Or his presence. Maybe it's, how do I deal in a world where I'm always afraid? Maybe you just realize that God's prayer, if he was with you, what might that do to your circumstance or your condition or your, what might that do? And what I want you to do, this is not an easy thing. You're not going to go, oh yeah, check. You're going to stop and really think about this. You're going to stop and think, how does your story connect with God's story? What are the implications of the gospel on your life? If it's just escape from hell and entrance into heaven, you're going to live a whole long time and miss a whole lot of what God's doing. Because I'll tell you what he has done for you right here, right now. That's what I want for you to get your eyes open and be able to see. What has he done for you? You see, this is what you do kind of as we end. The way you know this is true, let me one more thing before I give you the two questions. Everybody here demands to be justified. Every human being does. Either number one is they justify themselves by excuses, or number two, they justify themselves by effort. This is why you got to get this right. Here's what I mean. If you do something that you know you shouldn't have done, right? Whether it's speaking to someone a certain way, no matter what it is, your immediate fault is either to start making excuses. This is why what I did isn't as bad as you think it is. If my kids weren't this way, I wouldn't have to yell at them, right? You're justifying things that you know you don't want to do. Or you start effort. You're like, here, I'll make you some brownies because I was so bad, you know. And everybody, and it doesn't matter what it is, whether it's kids, whether it's your own personal life, whether it's your relationship with your wife, whether it's your coworkers, doesn't matter where it is. Everybody's, and usually it's some combination of both of these. When the excuses run out, we start to work harder. And you do this in your walk with God. And it poisons every other relationship that we have because we create this system. So here's my question. I want for you this week to simply think, what has been done? And you know the first thing you're going to think when you realize that he's forgiven you, he loves you, he's made you worthy, he's made you right, he's made, when all this things, you're like, okay, so I'll do, you start making promises. Don't make promises. All I want you to do is to stop and think, what has been done? What are the implications of him justifying you on your life? What are they? And then you say, what will I do in response to what has been done? You see, when you're sitting at the table and your bill's been paid, you can sit there a long time. You can sit there until the store closes. And you will never experience what has been done for you. It is only when you get up and you walk in the truth of what has been done that you begin to experience it. This is why Paul said, I have been crucified with Christ. It is no longer I who live, but it is Christ who lives in me. And this life I live in this body, I live by faith. I walk as though what has been done is true. What will you do about what's been done? Let's pray together. God, I thank you for this extraordinary way in which you have brought redemption and rightness to us. God, I ask that you would, even over the next few days, just saturate us with what you have done. We are justified by the cross. We have been guaranteed life by the resurrection. God, that every single moment of every single day, we are becoming more and more and more like we were intended to be. God, help us to see that. Help us to do the work regarding this. Father, not so that we can say, oh, look at us. We can actually begin to understand how our story is really a part of your story. God, that's what I ask. That's what I pray for. And I lift this to the name of your son, Jesus. And it is his name that we pray. Amen.